Hello everyone, I'm Professor Simon Robertshaw, Deputy Vice-Chancellor at Ravensbourne University London. Welcome to episode 3 of our Ravensbourne on Record podcast series. Today we're going to be exploring one of the biggest conversations in the tech space right now, meeting future skills needs. The tech industry is evolving at an unprecedented pace with advancements in artificial intelligence, automation, cybersecurity and digital transformation revolutionising the skills that employers require. So how can we make sure our workforce is ready to meet the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead? According to TechNation, the UK tech industry advertised over 2 million job vacancies in 2023 alone, with the call for AI, data analytics and cybersecurity specialists increased by over 30% year on year. However, the demand for skilled professionals continue to outstrip supply, with a significant skills gap emerging. A 2024 government report highlighted that 20% of businesses in the UK have an advanced technical skills gap, while a recent Forbes Advisor survey cited rapid technological advances, insufficient training opportunities, and a lack of relevant educational programs as a primary reason for skills gaps. Governments and industry leaders have repeatedly emphasised the need for a workforce equipped with the right digital and technical skills. The UK's own industrial strategy, alongside various tech sector reports, highlights the urgency of addressing the gap to maintain global competitiveness in the sector. Universities and educational institutions play a critical role in developing the next generation of tech talent, but challenges remain in aligning education programmes with industry needs, while ensuring accessibility and diversity within the sector. So what are the skills needed likely to be in the tech sector over the next 5 years? How should industry and education respond to meeting those needs? And how do you make the opportunities inclusive for all? I'm joined by an excellent panel who bring a wealth of insight and experience to the important discussion here. Allow me to introduce them. We have Jack Pershke, co-founder of Great Wave AI, Austin Pearl, Programme Manager of Education and EdTech at Tech UK, and Noreen Farhan, Course Leader in MSc Information Technology Management at Ravensbourne University, London. And thank you so much for joining us. So let's get started. So thanks so much for joining us today. And I guess my first question is about this explosion in tech, AI, cybersecurity, the advancement of technology that's impacting every part of our lives and business. So I'd just like to understand first from each of you how that's affected you and your sector and some of your thoughts on that explosion. So Austin, should we come to you first?
Yeah, very well too. So I at Tech UK, we obviously represent about 1,200 different tech companies. And I think collectively they employ about 1.1 million people in the UK, and AI has been a big deal in what we're doing, I think, to say the least. I head up EdTech, which is the technologies that are involved in institutions like Ravensbourne and schools. My focus is across education, but my background is more schools, and AI is taking over the sector in some respects.
And so do you think at the schools level that young people understand what the industry require and understand why AI or software engineering or tech or digital transformation is so important to their future career path, or is it still very alien to them?
I mean, it's patchwork. The system's fragmented, so some schools really get it. They do work with employers. They have kind of fully drunk the Kool-Aid when it comes to AI. Some really great teachers and practitioners that I work with. There's a chap called Alex Zarifa at the Arthur Terry Learning Partnership, who's been doing a lot of kind of future work preparedness around AI. So some schools and some trusts really get it. Others, it's not on their radar or just don't have the bandwidth, I think, to address it. We've got some shocking statistics, I think, around kind of computing in schools and access to expertise, and obviously we've got the curriculum change coming up. So hopefully that will address some of that.
Thanks. Noreen, how about you? How has it been impacting and what's your view on the AI revolution?
Yeah, talking about fourth industry revolution, considering AI in today's era, it has impacted in terms of more reliable and efficient connectivity and information security, as well as more enhanced capacity in terms of the communication. We are trying to make our assessments more project-based, mm-hmm. and which are linked with the real-world industry demands.
And for you, Jack, industry, this is your industry is in AI, so maybe tell us about the evolution of your company and your expertise.
Yeah, so as a sort of opening to that, I always worry about the kind of AI and everything itis, right? So I lived through the digital transformation when overnight we went from talking about technology or computing to talk about digital transformation, and everything became digital transformation, even stuff that 2 years before hadn't changed in 2 years but was suddenly now rebranded. And I think we're at risk of doing that again today with AI. In fact, I don't know if it's a risk, but we are doing it today. And so for me, I like to always carve out what we mean by AI. Essentially, there's a load of stuff that's been on a linear progression. So data science, machine learning, that is getting better and improving, but there hasn't been some big revolution in that. The big revolution that's happened is that through that data science, that machine learning progression, suddenly we've been able to talk to computers and they've been able to create things based on what we ask them to do. And that is wild, right? That is the stuff of science fiction. But that's the only big inflection we've had. Everything else is just a linear progression.
So my question for you is, in terms of one for the industry and educators here is there a need in here for a university to engage in industry retraining, reskilling? Before we come on back to the youth part and generating that, because Singapore have identified that as a key part, that every university now is getting money to deliver what we call a short course back into industry. And I think, is there a need within the UK to think about that need?
Yeah, and I think we are meeting, there's an announcement 2 days ago, maybe yesterday, whenever this is, around 187 million being invested in AI skills from DSIT. And there was a good report from IBM saying I think 40% of the workforce would have to reskill around AI, and I think that was last year that IBM published that report. So I think that there's definitely urgency, and there is I think recognition of that reskilling. I mean, the thing that I'm perhaps excited about a little bit is the role of technology in doing that reskilling around technology. Mm. So,
and Jack, do you see that? I mean, do you see that in your own company? You bring people in, I guess, who have those skills. So is that an issue for you in terms of reskilling in your organisation?
Again, we're a very contrary AI company, because most people sat here and go, we need a million more PhDs. We literally don't care about that. It's not really our bag. But what I do think is that, the idea of law have done this for a long time, but a law conversion course, right? I do think the idea of conversion courses is something that the UK should embrace more. I'm on my third career, some sort of related, but not really. And I think it will be entirely normal that people will end their working lives doing something totally different from what they were doing in their 40s. And that should be normalised socially and educationally and every other way.
That's what we were speaking earlier, that now these days the students need to learn the adaptability, that how they can make themselves adaptable to the changing technologies, because this is the era where the technologies, they are changing so fast that it is very important for them to upskill, to reskill themselves when they enter the industry.
And I think in some areas of the university, what we're trying to create is this simulation of industry. So rather than, a thesis or whatever it might be, that it is the skills that you will get here will be simulated out there. So is that something that interests you from an educational point of view and an industry point of view, that it's a simulation of what we do, or is there other?
Well, I think the answer, there's a few things. in that. But the answer, to cut straight to that, is outside that door. So for those listening or watching, outside the door is this amazing collection of your students' fashion artwork, right? And it's practical and it's made and it's beautiful and it's output focused and it's craft. And it doesn't matter if they've used a sewing machine or hand sewn it or, you know, what technology they've used to create that. It's the output that matters, and it's that focus on that output. And we realize that in our creative industries. Yeah. And yet somehow when we're training on the more vocational or the more, I don't know what you would describe it, the more technical courses, we forget that what matters is the output. So for us, we care about people that can imaginatively solve problems end to end, and that might mean not just that they can write amazing code, it means they can also meet a user and understand their needs, translate that into a user design, user-centered design, and translate that into code. Like, we would like people, I think the days of the sort of factory coding are gone. We're moving into technology as craft, and we need to think about that, and technologists as craftspeople.
Yeah, that's what we are doing. You're right, because as you are aware that we recently were doing course developments for the postgraduate and undergraduate programs in computing, and this is what we are trying to achieve through our modules and through our new courses, that the students will be able to develop certain artifacts and certain portfolios that would help them in showcasing their skills and what they can do when they enter the industry.
Just coming on the craftsmanship piece, because one of my first jobs in London was working for a company called Skills Matter, which is all around software engineering skills, data skills. And one of the groups that I used to support was called the London Software Craftsmanship Community, which still goes on today. And actually, I did a brief year's work working for the organisers of that community that still runs, been running for probably about, I want to say 10 years, but it might be longer. So the craftsmanship piece, I think, is a long-standing element of the community in terms of its self-organisation, in terms of software engineering and tech skills. And I think you're in a really lucky place in London. There's hundreds of meetups, industry-based meetups, Product Tank, one of the largest product-based community meetups in London, in terms of meeting people who are doing the job and want to continue their skills. And I think tapping into those communities, a real strength for universities, but then also employers. And the other thing I wanted to mention as well, we hosted an event earlier this year, which was supposed to be a kind of a rethinking of secondary education, or rethinking of K-12 education. And we had an education psychologist there who said, when technology changes so fast, there's one thing that doesn't change too fast, and that's kind of the human brain. You know, we're not kind of physiologically going to change that much. Which I found really interesting, because I think there's a reason to call back to, you know, what is it that would be really valuable to learn in terms of human psychology and development that would be applicable no matter what.
Okay, so let's move that on a bit. So in terms of the sector and your areas, I guess, and industry, what are the most in-demand skills from your perceptions at the moment?
Yeah. Talking about the skills that are more in demand considering this era, yes, I think considering AI, artificial intelligence, we are now in the world of IoTs, industrial IoTs, and these are everywhere, like the digital transformation that is all based on the sensors, talking about robotics and whatever field that you talk about, whenever you are mentioning AI or machine learning, it is all about these IoTs and the sensors that we are working with. So yes, the skills that are more in demand these days or in future will be more related to AI in IoTs, industrial IoTs, considering Industry 4.0 and 5.0, and the cybersecurity for having more secure information in the industry or in the organizations, how the data dealing with or managing big data how the data has to be managed or could be managed and keeping it secure at the same time. Along with that, yes, whenever we talk about AI, there is actually the algorithms that we are talking about. So yes, the machine learning algorithms that are need to be known, how those algorithms can be embedded and how those algorithms can be implemented to gain the required outputs or the results.
So from our members, I was briefed to say four things or five things, and then I've got something I wanted to say. But because essentially my colleague Nimi heads up our skills, so we're constantly engaging our members about what skills they want to see, and there are four. So there's AI, data, cyber. I'm going to completely forget. Oh, cloud is the other one. Mm-hmm. So these are the four that I was briefed to say. But then also on top of that, green skills. So this is an area I think we're kind of 80,000 individuals short of our green skills economy. And I think that's a really big area that certainly we're really interested in. We've got a kind of dedicated net zero and green program that's received quite a lot of attention. And then the other thing I think, and really interested to hear your opinion as well on this, Jack, is there's a historicity, I think, around tech. Raspberry Pi Foundation came out the other day to say, no, AI doesn't mean that we have to stop learning software engineering. If anything, we should continue to really pressure on learning software engineering. And they made some really good points. I recommend going off and reading that. And I also think there's historicity around technology that's really important. We often, looking at legacy modernization contracts for government, oftentimes you'll need someone who understands COBOL and documentation from older programming languages. And you're bringing people out of retirement on quite expensive contracts to look through the historicity of what's been going on with the project. So I think there is value in certainly learning in maintaining certain software languages or skills. But yeah, if that's something that you see.
Yeah, so there's a few things. So I think that the most in demand, this is going to sound really, I don't know if it's going to sound cliched or perverse, one or the other, but the most in demand tech skills are people skills, right? Ultimately, because you can always find someone who knows how to code their way out of that problem, but can you find someone who can do that within the context of a team, within the context of a demanding client, within the context of a time constraint, within the context of, whatever it is, it's all the stuff on top. Like, solving the problem is never the issue. It's how you solve it and how you operate with others who are also trying to solve it or indeed not trying to solve it. And so my general view on life, and this is me massively overreaching my area of expertise and I'm conscious of the company I'm in, but my general view on life is that people have aptitudes, things that they're broadly more aligned to, and there might be a handful of those. And then they just have qualities. And some people are really creative, and some people are super completer finishers, and some people whatever it is. You just have to understand, you have to know yourself, where you fit, where your aptitudes are and what your qualities are. So I know I have zero attention to detail. Right? I cannot read a contract. I can get halfway down the first page. I just physically can't read it. Like, it's just, I'm gone. There's something else going on in my brain. And so when we founded our business, I knew I needed someone who had, who could read, right? Who had real attention to detail. So one of my co-founders is an amazing details person. He would have a much, very different answer to this question. But ultimately, I think it is all about building those teams, because almost nothing, and oh gosh, the thing that winds me up more than anything that's going on LinkedIn at the moment is everyone looking for the first unicorn that only has one member of staff. And I mean, it's just insane madness. There is nothing that isn't created through a team, through networks of people, and you've got to understand your role within those teams. You've got to get behind it, stop resisting it. I spent years of my life trying to convince myself I could be a details person. You've just got to be happy in your own skin. And then lean into your talents and your capabilities. So I'm not saying everyone go into a pigeonhole and thing. And I think, by the way, schools are a bit responsible for this, partly because they do, they find someone who's good at art and they like saying, well, you should go and be a fashion designer. But actually, yeah, there's brilliant graphic design, you know, there's brilliant design jobs in any kind of industry. And anyway, so I think that we, yeah, the skill I would like to see people get better at is understanding their strengths and being imaginative and creative about where that can be applied to.
Okay, a question for you, and maybe start with you, Jack. So this is really about the synergy between education and industry, and I think Ravensbourne's always been very proud of that connection to industry. But how do you think, you know, we can future-proof that in terms of that collaboration between industry and a university? You know, what are the elements that you would see that you might, I'm not suggesting your company would provide, but you know, what does the university need to do more of, I guess?
Yeah. I think education's in a funny place. You know, the sort of the old trope about education is that, you know, the reason we have these long summer holidays is because kids used to have to go home to do the harvest, and we've just been landed with it. And despite no one going home to do the harvest really anymore, we still have these mad long summer holidays. And I think we're probably going to be in the same place. Why do we have these big three-year pre-work education periods? It's not entirely clear to me why that exists. And I'm biased because I had a weird education path. I left school, went into the workplace, came back, did a master's sort of 8 years later, went back into the workplace, did another master's, back into the workplace. So I am a big advocate for, you know, what has worked well for me in my personal experience, which is, you know, a sound basic education and then a sort of revolving door between workplace and education. And actually my second master's was an executive MBA, so it was done 1 week stint, 1 week every 6 weeks. So, you know, so I think the more flexible we can be about how people earn the badges that they require to progress, the better that is for education institutions and the better it is for industry.
So Noreen, there's a challenge there, isn't there? I mean, we are doing some of this already, but maybe you could expand on that a little bit more in terms of Ravensbourne and how we're working and maybe what we could take advantage of and think about for the future skills.
Yeah, what we are already doing is like we are already having people from industry and they help in designing and looking at improving our curriculum. And this is what we are doing, like this is how this gap could be covered, like when it has to be a two-way partnership between the academia and industry, and where people from the industry would be invited and they give their feedback or their insights about the curriculum models. Mm-hmm. And we as educators would appreciate their suggestions and would embrace the suggestions and try to adapt our teaching methodologies according to that. And in this way, I think what I feel is that it has to be a two-way partnership between the industry. And this is what we are doing at Ravensbourne. Ravensbourne is doing this. Like, we are moving towards, or we are working on the industry-focused or industry-led curriculum design and models.
Yeah. And Austin, for you, I guess you are working closely with industries and tech and education.
And certainly, so a lot of our members, you know, a lot of the kind of big multinationals, but also a lot of the SMEs we work with, very keen to work with universities. And I think one of the challenges I've set myself is within my work with higher education is to better understand what a good broad partnership looks like with the tech sector. Because at the moment you'll have your CTO, your CIO, engaged with the tech sector based on a supplier end user relationship, very transactional. You might have tech industry players come in and through various mechanisms to engage in the course design. You might have partnerships, you know, thinking of like Nokia Bell Labs in Cambridge or Google DeepMind up in with Camden Council for their sixth form students. There's partnerships that are kind of transactional, one and done. I think what I'd like to see is perhaps a broader vehicle where universities can have a constant relationship with the tech sector. I'm not sure how, you know, as an institution, you bring together the various different individuals that have a relationship with a tech supplier or a tech partner and evaluate how you can kind of eke out the most value on that. But I think there's a maturity in the relationship there that I don't see as being as widespread across the sector, maybe with institutions like your own, that is kind of well adapted, but in others perhaps not.
Yeah, I guess there's different levels of partnerships, you know, here. I mean, we're very proud to have, you know, our one of our alumni, Richard Howarth, who's head of design at Apple in San Francisco, UK, obviously studied product design here. And that's one of the conversations we're having with Richard is, you know, how can we collaborate with a large multinational like Apple, who are, you know, let's say are quite restrictive in many, and you can imagine why. But actually, in terms of course development, they've done some course development with San Francisco Art Design out there. And so how can we build a relationship, you know, that's solid? And those Apple staff are actually teaching on that course. And I think that's a synergy that we're quite proud of. Many of our staff have good and still work in industry. You know, our course leader for product broadcast engineering still works at Newsnight. So that relationship is one type of partnership. But I guess what we're trying to grasp now is more of a strategic relationship that gives a lot more. And I guess, you know, just moving that on slightly, one of the challenges for what we're very proud of here at Ravensbourne is our diversity of our students. And I know that's something that's a challenge in many industries is bringing in diverse people with the right skills. So do you see that challenge in your own sectors? Maybe we'll start with you.
Yeah, large diversity challenges. And I think this starts from schools, as Jack mentioned earlier, around pigeonholing students into certain pathways. And again, I think I mentioned that for good earlier, good charities, lots of good charities, TechSheCan, Guildhall Code, lots of great organisations trying to shift the focus further leftwards, I think, in terms of an individual's development and appreciation of technology. And also lots of other partners that we work with, like UKI, which is the Association for the Gaming Industry, who I'm sure you work with as well, to look at actually how is it that technology and creative industries can be much more surfaced, I think, in the kind of career mindedness of students and teachers. But yeah, I think we've got a way to go.
Yeah, kind of talking about diversity, like we at Ravensbourne, first thing that we have at Ravensbourne is that we have Students Union that helps students and with if they have any issues. Moreover, with the module designing and module curriculum development, we keep in mind while we are designing the module descriptors that that would fit diverse people, diverse learners, I must say, from different cultures that are joining our institution. Also, we have a lot of international learners for our postgraduate programs as well. So we do keep the diversity and inclusivity in our curriculum and in our development.
And is it still predominantly male in the computing area? Is it, would you say, from your experience teaching, is it still predominantly male students that are studying, or is it changing?
Yes, male students. Yeah,
because that is a challenge. You know, it's a bit like engineering in the old.
Yes,
well, still is an issue in engineering. You know, not many women or young women are taking that up.
In one of the courses that I was teaching in the previous term, there was one female, and there were one female, and there were I think 20 male students in MSc cybersecurity,
which is difficult in itself. I mean, just being the one person,
within
20 males is challenging for them in itself.
Yes,
the gender issue in technology is a nightmare. I was thinking about the answer to your question. We basically have one good story, which is our, you know, sort of background and racial diversity in our business, and one bad story, which is gender. We literally don't have any women in our business at the moment. Mm. It's just too. It's just hard to find them. They are not around. And you know, when you've got courses of one female student, you can see how that's happening. But I don't know what the solve for that is. Because, you know, I feel like we should just look to medicine, because it wasn't so long ago. Medicine was a male-only career, and now there's tons of women in it.
Yes.
And it's technical, and it's sciencey, and it's like there is. It doesn't make any sense to me. But on this sort of the sort of demographic diversity, which I think is actually the most important. Like, I'm most interested in people from different backgrounds because they come with different perspectives. The biggest hinderer to that is something we were talking about earlier, which is technology. People's obsession with PhDs. And PhDs from certain universities, right? If your biggest advert for your business is that 80% of your staff have PhDs from Stanford, right? I think you've got a terrible business, because I think if your business demands tons of PhDs to run, then it's not very sustainable, it's not very scalable. You haven't really solved the problem. You're just hiring tons of people to solve a million problems all at once. But investors love PhDs from Stanford office. And the number of investor conversations I've had with people like, so Jack, you know, who in your team has got a PhD from top university? Like, none of them. And I'm incredibly proud of that because that isn't, in my view, any benchmark of success. But the problem is, so long as investors are obsessing over this stuff, we're embedding in the startup community all of the barriers and biases of all those institutions, right? Mm-hmm. And so suddenly the startup community starts reflecting what the Stanford PhD course looks like, because they're the ones getting all the money. Mm-hmm. And suddenly then, because they're the ones getting the money, that's what good looks like, and it's all a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if we actually took a step back and went, what business is solving sensible problems in sensible ways with good people, and let's ignore the badges, I think we'd be in a much better place.
Okay, that's great. So my final wrap-up question is really blue sky. You know, what thing would you wish to have or do if sky's the limit in terms of changing, you know, the turning the dial on future skills and giving skills to everyone that
The biggest thing for me is equality of access to technology, if we're going to think about tech skills.
That's still an issue, right? Yeah.
It is still an issue. In fact, you know, it's an issue I'm trying to get some accurate data on, but we've got a couple of surveys that were produced recently around it's only small pools of individuals, I think about 1,000 teachers, around access to technology within schools, and it's not a pretty picture, I think, for a lot of the country. And there's also, with the lack of technology, also is the lack of kind of computing teachers. I think something around the area of about 37% of schools in poorer areas don't have access to computing teachers, which measured against wealthier areas is about 11%. So the difference, I think, the disparity in expertise, and then the disparity in access not just to devices but to good networks, and then to the skills required in our education system. Yeah.
Yeah. Lori.
Yeah. For me, I would love to have an industry-led ecosystem, digital ecosystem, where the educators, learners, and people from the industry, they could come together and work for the future skills. And which would also ensure the interdisciplinary collaboration among different domains that would help in refining the skills of the learners, of the people, whoever is involved in that on that platform. That is good. That will be helpful for them to improve their skills and or learning new skills to beat the market.
I guess it goes back to Jack's point about schools and where you're siloed into graphic. I mean, it's not that unlike that here. You know, we don't have faculties here, but you have, you know, your streams of activity. And, you know, the challenge here that we're beginning to do, you know, how an architect works with a fashion designer, or how a fashion designer works with a tech, you know. And I think that's that ecosystem and involving industry, and that I think is where it's at, because my challenge is to the universities, your point, why are we doing 3 years of this where you have two semesters, a massive break, and then come back? it's quite an antiquated method of delivering when that's not what industry wants, you know. And that's something that Ravensbourne is beginning to do, is to think about, you know, fast tracking or 1 year or whatever it might be. That's a different model than this quite antiquated old-fashioned university sector way of doing things that was fine 40 years ago, but it's not fine now, I think.
Well, I think I totally agree with all of that. I think we've talked about the cross-disciplinary thing, which is massive, because, and I mentioned it before, no organisation works in isolation, so whatever you want to do, you're going to be doing it with other people. And then you talked about inequality of access to technology, which I also agree with, but I think the build on that is inequality of access to expectation, right? So I've talked before how we think that talent is evenly spread and opportunity is not, so we go and look where opportunity is low. But in those areas where opportunity is low, often personal expectations are low. So where people don't think that they can go and work for a swanky London AI company where they actually can, and they self-select themselves out. They don't think that, and then on the next, you know, they don't think necessarily that standards apply to them, and so they end up selecting themselves out from that process. But if we can set, if we can, you know, we can be realists and go, right, opportunity will always be unevenly distributed, but if a government or a society, we can agree that people's expectations should be equal. We should all expect and demand to attain more, then I think that would be fantastic for everyone. That would be my kind of, like, if I had a magic button to change, set expectations higher across the board.
Great. Well, we think at Ravensbourne we're trying to get to some of those solutions, you know, and look to industry to support us in that as well. But listen, thank you very much for your contributions today. It's been an excellent conversation. I could go on and go on and go on, actually. But thank you very much for your contributions. Really, really, really excellent. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.